Welcome to Health Affairs Conversations. I'm your host, Chris Fleming. As many of our regular readers know, Health Affairs publishes two papers every year focusing on national health expenditures. The first paper, which appears in our January issue, looks at the most recent annual health spending figures available. The second paper projects spending over the coming decade. These papers are written by authors in the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Office of the Actuary. Their work is considered the gold standard when it comes to measuring health spending, and we are grateful for our continuing partnership with them. Today, I will talk with Gigi Kuckler, an economist in the Actuary's office and one of the authors of the just-published 2013 Spending Projections paper, which estimates health spending through 2022. The study is available in full for 1 week on the Health Affairs website, www.healthaffairs.org. After Gigi discusses some of the key findings in the paper, we'll turn to two noted health policy experts, Uwe Reinhardt and Jim Capretta. Jim and Uwe will provide their take on the CMS paper and offer their views on health spending and where it might go from here. Gigi, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to share our results.
Well, I'd like to start by asking you to talk about your paper a little bit. Give us what, in your view, are the highlights, the key takeaways from your work in this paper.
Sure. From a broad perspective, over the full projection period from 2012 through 2022, national health spending is projected to grow at an average rate of 5.8%. And this is one percentage point faster than expected average annual growth in the economy over the period. Now, consequently, we project that the share of GDP will increase from 17.9% in 2011 to 19.9% by 2022. Now, in the near term of the projections through 2013, we're projecting that national health spending will remain just under 4%. And this is due to the sluggish economic recovery, continued increases in cost-sharing requirements for the privately insured, as well as low growth in both Medicare and Medicaid. Now, however, in 2014, we project that national health spending growth will accelerate to 6.1%. And this is reflecting expanded insurance coverage that will become available through the Affordable Care Act. After 2014, through the remainder of the projection period, national health spending is projected to grow 6.2% per year on average. And this is largely as a result of continued implementation of the coverage expansions under reform, faster projected economic growth, the aging of the population, as well as the ending of the sequester. Now, while this growth is faster compared to recent experience surrounding the recession, it is still slower than the growth experienced over the longer-term history.
Well, as you know, there's an ongoing debate about how much of the recent slowdown in health spending growth is permanent and how much is tied specifically to the economy, the lingering effects of the financial crisis, the continued weakness in the economy. And there, if that second theory is true, obviously, as the economy improves, then health spending would continue to grow back to historical rates. Can you tell us what your projections, what light your projections might reflect on this debate?
So there have been a lot of significant changes in the health sector over the past 3 years. With the continued slower growth in health spending after the recent recession, there certainly have been questions raised about whether or not there's a more fundamental change occurring in the health sector. However, analysis by our office of the past 50 years of national health expenditure accounts data, which explored the relationship between economic and health spending growth, suggests that health spending growth is likely to accelerate once economic conditions improve significantly, though with a lag. Now, consequently, we just aren't convinced yet that this long-standing relationship between economic and health spending growth has been broken.
So I know you've just said that you're not convinced that these fundamental shifts have broken that relationship. But to the extent that you do see factors that have changed in significant fundamental ways, what are the particular ones that you would point to as being most significant? Technology introduction, payment reform, higher cost sharing, what are the ones that you feel are most significant?
So with the evolving health sector, there have been changes that may persist as the economy continues to recover, which could contribute to slower growth. For example, some of the impact of people moving to higher deductible health plans could continue to impact spending growth through the first half of the projection period, as these types of plans tend to discourage the use of coverage services by enrollees. Even if the growth of high deductible plans diminishes somewhat because of a stronger economy in the future, the lingering impact of increases in cost-sharing deductibles over the last several years is one factor that we see contributing to our projections of spending growth around 6% in the second half of the projection period. And that's compared to growth that we looked at over 1990 to 2007 of around 7%. Now, another thing that's important to keep in mind is that some of the slower growth we've seen over the past few years was caused by temporary or one-time factors. And these include factors like the sequester, as I mentioned before, the expiration of the enhanced federal Medicaid assistance percentage rate, as well as the patent cliff for the prescription drug market. The patent cliff in particular, relating to patent expirations for drugs like Lipitor and Plavix, have resulted in historically low growth in drug spending, but with the largest impacts projected for 2012 and 2013. While there are some factors that may continue to dampen growth in spending after the economy recover, there were also several factors that slowed in recent years but were somewhat temporary.
One of the projections that are sure to get a lot of attention in your paper is that health spending financed by government, federal, state, and local, will account for 45% of health spending in 2012, will rise to 49% by 2022, almost half. Talk about what factors contributed to that increase.
The projected increase in the government share of spending over this time, share of spending financed by government, over this time is really primarily related to factors that increase the federal government share of healthcare financing from 26% in 2012 up to 31% in 2022. And the principal factors behind this are related to health reform, such as expanded Medicaid eligibility under the coverage expansions, as well as premium and cost-sharing subsidies for coverage through the marketplace plans. In addition, the aging of the population also impacts this rate of increase as growth in Medicare enrollment from baby boomers continuing to enter the program contributes to this.
Well, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and I wonder if you could talk a little more about how it factors into your projections. I think you projected a fairly large increase in coverage, obviously, but a pretty small increase in health spending growth. Is that right?
Talking broadly about the role of the Affordable Care Act over the projection period from 2012 through 2022, the cumulative effects of reform are projected to reduce the number of uninsured Americans by 30 million, add approximately a tenth of a percentage point to average annual growth in spending over the period, and increase cumulative health spending by $621 billion. But as you mentioned, you kind of focused on that tenth of a percentage point. Here, it's important to note that these net impacts of the Affordable Care Act on total health spending mask the underlying effects we see on payer spending levels and growth rates, and they're much more pronounced over the period. For example, national health spending paid for by out-of-pocket rises from 11% in 2011, declines from 11% in 2011 down to 9% by 2022, as many Americans will now have coverage for healthcare services previously paid for out-of-pocket. And on the other hand, spending in national health expenditures from Medicaid accounts for 15% of spending in 2011 and rises to nearly 17% by 2022, primarily as a result of the coverage expansions under reform. And these aggregate impacts I discussed tend to mask some of these things that we see when we look at things a little more closely by year. So, for example, in 2012, estimated Medicare spending growth fell to 4.6% from 6.2% in 2011, despite faster enrollment growth in the baby boomers. And that's partly attributable to provisions of the Affordable Care Act that reduce the rate at which payments for certain providers are updated. And then in 2014 and 2015, the most substantial effects of the implementation of health insurance expansions under reform can be seen in national health spending. Growth in national health spending is projected to accelerate to 6.1% in 2014, which is 1.6% faster than projected in the absence of reform. And this reflects 11 million Americans gaining coverage through either Medicaid or the health insurance marketplaces. And this expansion of coverage now is projected to increase the demand for health care, particularly for prescription drugs and physician and clinical services, as the populations gaining coverage are anticipated to be somewhat younger and healthier and require relatively less acute care, such as hospital services. And in 2015, we expect that health spending growth will remain near 6% as the major effects of the coverage expansions are projected to continue. However, after 2015, the most significant one-time effects of the coverage expansions are expected to subside, although the Medicare spending growth will continue to be constrained over the period by provisions that reduce some payment updates to providers, for certain providers.
Now, you've talked in discussing the ACA and its impact on your projections. You talked about the coverage gains. You talked about the payment cut formula change provisions of the ACA. Do you project savings? Are you ready to take into account some of the delivery reforms, payment reforms that are in the ACA? And do you, in your projections, predict that those will save money, or are we not there yet?
So as far as the most significant elements of the ACA savings, those really are the Medicare productivity adjustments are really the most substantial, as well as the lower payments to Medicare private plans. While there are other factors that contribute to slower spending growth, their impact is relatively smaller. With regards to the delivery and alternative payment reforms under the Affordable Care Act, the Innovation Center was created in CMS to test some of these new alternative delivery and payment innovations. And we've incorporated some modest savings from these reforms, although at this time, many of these innovations are still in development, and it's really too early to tell how significant their impact may be over the longer term.
And finally, I want you to talk a little bit about two updates in your methodology that seem to me pretty significant. One is that you incorporate now the Supreme Court decision on the Medicaid expansion, essentially allowing states to opt out of that. And two, I think you're in your numbers, you assume that the SDR cuts, the cuts to physician payments, Medicare physician payments that are called for under current law, that those will not occur. Am I right on those two updates? And can you talk a little bit about how they affect your projections?
You are correct that we did incorporate both those things. So going over at a high level the changes, regarding the Supreme Court decision, the June 2012 Supreme Court decision ruling stated that states would not lose their federal funding for existing Medicaid programs if they did not implement the eligibility expansion under health reform. As a result, our projections for Medicaid spending and enrollment are lower than previously estimated, as not all states are expected to expand their programs. Further, of the states that do elect to expand their Medicaid programs, some may choose to expand their programs after 2014. Thus, while in last year's projections we projected total Medicaid spending of 18% in 2014, this year we're projecting total Medicaid spending growth of 12.2% in 2014. Regarding enrollment, some of the individuals that would have been covered under the expanded state Medicaid program are expected to obtain coverage through other options, such as subsidized coverage through the marketplaces. And for more information about the detailed methodology behind these Medicaid projections, you can refer to our Financial Outlook report on the status of Medicaid, available at www.medicaid.gov. Regarding the change in the emphasis from the current law scenario with the effects of the Sustainable Growth Rate Formula, or SGR, to the focus from the current law scenario, including the effects of the SGR. Under current law, we have that the SGR formula calls for a 24.7% reduction in Medicare physician payment rates as of 2014. Now, based on the history of legislative overrides of the SGR every year since 2003, the projections presented in our report emphasize the scenario from the Medicare Trustees Report that is current law with an alternative scenario, or with an alternative to the sustainable growth rate. Now, we believe that these projections with the alternative to the SGR are more useful to policymakers and the public, as they represent a more realistic outlook of future payment rates. That being said, we have presented both scenarios in the report. Under current law, the scenario with the, including the SGR, our projection of national health spending would be 5.6% in 2014, compared to 6.1% with an alternative to the SGR.
Well, Gigi, that's great. I really appreciate the overview you've given us and all the work that you and your co-authors put into this paper and each and every installment of these wonderful spending projections and retrospective spending measurements that you do every year. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much again for giving us the opportunity to share these results. We appreciate working with you as well.
The complete study authored by Gigi and her colleagues at CMS is on the Health Affairs website, www.healthaffairs.org. And while you're visiting our website, you might also want to read our health policy briefs. They provide clear, accessible overviews of important health policy topics. The briefs, which are available for free, are produced by Health Affairs through a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Joining me now to discuss their views on health spending and the CMS estimates are James Capretta, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and Uwe Reinhardt, the James Madison Professor of Political Economy at Princeton University. Both Jim and Uwe are frequent Health Affairs contributors and members of our editorial board. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
I'm here.
Well, you heard Gigi talk about the paper, and you've had a chance to look at it. I'd like to ask you both to start by saying, you know, what you thought were the main takeaways for you from this work. What struck you as particularly interesting or surprising or significant? What do you think should be highlighted for our listeners? Uwe, why don't we start with you?
Well, first of all, before I get into that, I do want to congratulate Gigi and her colleagues. I wonder how many people know how much work goes into these forecasts. I served on the Medicare Technical Advisory Panel a couple of years ago, where our task was to rake over everything they do and judge whether what they did was reasonable or not. And in the process, I really learned how much work and sophistication goes into these forecasts. Now, as they say in the paper, they're all uncertain, just like any business plan. You know, we do five-year business plans at board meetings, and they never really come about either. But this is as good as it gets, in my view. So I think at some point that should be said. As to these forecasts, now in the past, we've had these ups and downs. We've had five periods where health spending grew no faster than GDP in the last 30 years or so. And so it's natural to say, oh, well, health spending in recent years has been down, but it'll go up again as it always did. I personally am persuaded that won't happen, not to the extent we've had it. But their forecast here strikes me as reasonable, because some of the cost savings in the last few years, as they point out, and I agree, were driven by the recession. There is a lagged relationship. The Altarum Institute and Kaiser, together with Tom Getson, did a simulation, and close to 85% of the changes in the growth of health spending can be explained just by changes in gross domestic product, and they quite correctly point this out. And if we assume the economy will grow more quickly in the future, we should expect some increase in health spending. But there are also these structural changes they allude to, and I think they're quite important. The increased cost sharing on the part in the private sector does probably reduce utilization. At least every piece of empirical research I've seen points out to that. And then this is a little harder to quantify. I do believe there is a mood among the payers for a harder pushback on prices. You may notice in this paper, it's quite astounding how low the price inflation. I think you had 1.1% in recent years, and they don't project huge increases in price inflation. Most of the increases that they project have to do with more insured, in other words, more people covered, and the growth of the number of elderly because of the retiring baby boom. So I think what really struck me is the low forecast on prices that they had. And maybe Gigi can tell us a little bit more how they got to that. But I actually believe it. What do you think, Jim?
Well, first I want to also sort of join with Uwe and congratulate the staff that put this together, Gigi and her team. It's a remarkable product, very, very thorough. And I think, as always, we'll have great interest in the health policy world as it gets devoured by everybody because it's very thorough and chock full of interesting insights. With respect to some of the things that I took away from it, I want to also echo what Uwe just said about the connection between the economy and the projections. Obviously, they mentioned it in their presentation as well, and it's quite clear that, you know, when you have 50 years of econometric analysis of the data going into this, and essentially what they're saying is that the slowdown in the spending tracks with the historical record to a large degree, and one would expect the economy to rebound, you know, more forcefully here in the coming years, then one should definitely expect the continued relationship between GDP and national health expenditure or spending growth to resume and continue. Yeah, I don't think there's any real evidence that one should assume a big break between the two. The second obvious point is that, you know, not to put too much of a political overlay on this, is that there's been some intimation from the administration and in some news accounts that the healthcare law itself was responsible for some of the slowdown. I just don't see any evidence in this paper or anywhere else to support that point of view. Certainly the Secretary of HHS sort of has said that, at least on one or two occasions, fairly explicitly. I don't believe that's the case. To the extent that there is any slowdown in spending associated with the healthcare law, it is in the area where the authors indicated. It's in essentially an across-the-board cutting mechanism in the payment rates for inpatient hospital care, a so-called productivity adjustment factor, which is kicking in now and will continue on in perpetuity. And the second is the reduction in the payment rates for the private plans providing care in Medicare, the Medicare Advantage plans. Those are fairly substantial reductions that are noticeable in the expenditure data. And the question is whether or not they're going to be sustained. I think there's a big question around both of them. It's fairly notable that the Medicare Advantage cuts are so politically sensitive that in some ways the administration has tried to soften them through administrative action in the last couple of years. I think that would be an indicator that trying to sustain the much deeper reductions that are coming in the future will be hard to sustain. Similarly, with the productivity adjustment factor, the actuary's office itself has made a point in the trustees' reports of the last several years, going back to enactment of the law in 2010, to note that they don't think that they are sustainable over the, and I would say more the medium and long run, not necessarily within the projection window that this analysis looks at, but near the end of this window and then beyond. I think the judgment of the actuary's office has been that it would be difficult to sustain because of the large differential that is likely to occur between the rates that are being used through public payers and the rates that are being used by private payers, causing some access problems for the enrollees in the public programs. So I think those are a couple of reasons why the estimates actually might be a little bit optimistic going forward, let me add one more to that mix, of course, which is the sequester, that in the near term, you know, essentially the Medicare number is being reduced by 2% because of the sequester. This projection assumes that sequester is going to remain in place through the rest of the so-called Budget Control Act period. That's possible, although I do think that even that is much more likely to be revisited at some point, although the political process at the moment doesn't look like it's going to be able to make a big change in that area. It's hard to imagine it happening every year for the next 8 years.
Jim, are you actually casting doubt on our capacity for bipartisan cooperation in our political sphere?
Well, that's always a safe bet in the near term, yeah.
Go ahead, Uwe, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to voice my agreement. I also believe the ACA had basically nothing to do with the bending of the cost curve in the last few years. I know the president, I think, has claimed it, and maybe the Secretary of Health, but it would be very hard when you close your eyes to think what it could have been that would have done this. And the paper here says nothing about it quite correctly, because I don't think anything could be attributed to the ACA. In the future, this 2% sequester cut and the 1.1% productivity gain built into the updates of hospitals and some other facilities, I think the question is, well, whether that will be sustained. We thought when we were on this advisory panel that maybe for a decade you could do it, that there's enough fat in hospitals that if they really used better industrial engineering processes, they might be able to grind out this kind of productivity gain. You know, that accumulates over a decade to about 11.5%, close to 12% in reductions. And there is a real question. It's just like, how long can you stay underwater without coming up for new air? Whether they can hold out for a whole decade with that, I don't know. Maybe. But for the long run, Rick Foster, I think he spoke on that, when you run this out for 50 years, that 1% productivity gain, I'm not sure is that easily attained. You would have to have tremendous technology with labor-saving devices to achieve that. I think this is sort of for the very short run. Next 5 years, for sure, you could do it. But even 10 years is a stretch. So I agree with Jim on those points. The reason, I think, on pricing, I am amazed how much activity there is on price transparency, flushing out some of the absurdities in our system. And this sleeper, the WellPoint that they did with Castlight on reference pricing, where you basically tell the insured, if you go to this and this and this hospital, we have deals with them, we'll pay. But if you go to anyone else, you pay the whole difference between what they charge you and what we would give you. This is called reference pricing, used mainly for drugs in Europe. But if what WellPoint did for CalPERS insured, if that spread, that could have significant pressure on prices, maybe even negative inflation on prices. So there's a lot of uncertainty, stuff floating around. But those are these structural changes we're talking about that really could bend the cost curve down, not quite as much as it was in the last, say, 4 years, but nevertheless, less than it used to be in the past 40 years. Because in the past 40 years, health spending on average in the longer run grew 2 percentage points faster than the growth in GDP. I just don't think we'll go back to that as far as the eye can see. You guys have it at GDP plus 0.3. It might go up GDP plus 0.7, I like 0.78. I like the sound sophisticated, so I'd make it 0.78, GDP plus 0.78. But I don't think it'll ever go even above GDP plus 1%. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I think I basically agree with you that there's too much pressure are out in the system now for it to jump back up to that kind of a level again. But on the other hand, we essentially still have in our national health system two systems that remain open, somewhat open-ended in terms of taxpayer financing. The open-ended subsidy for employer-paid health insurance, which now has a high-cost insurance tax, but it's not quite the same as closing off that provision at the worker level. And then the second is the Medicare program itself, where you have a cap that would be enforced through the IPAB, but the beneficiary still has essentially unlimited ability to use services at a regulated pricing rate. So it's between those two things. There's still lots of demand, third-party insurance demand for services baked right into our system. And in good economic times, that is quite a ratchet upward on expenses and costs and the overall, I think that's the biggest reason why our national health spending system looks and is shaped the way it has been over the last several decades, is because of that third-party insurance system driven by employer plans and Medicare. And fundamentally, yes, it's changing to some degree, but it hasn't fundamentally changed yet, if I could put it that way.
That's true. That's fair enough. Fundamentally, I mean, it's at the margin, like higher deductibles, somewhat higher cost sharing, and then this tinkering with the productivity gain. I think that's all true. And I think till about a year ago, I was one of the skeptics. I even wrote about it. Because when you draw the curve of health spending per capita over time, and it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down, you sort of wonder what would prevent it from the growth rate going up again. I just think, first of all, I am not so optimistic on rapid economic growth, for starters. And then secondly, even if there were, I do believe there will be more pushback on prices, because we will have the data, we have the computer system. There are a lot of young entrepreneurs, like Castlight, for example, who want to make a living off that. So I think the luxury the providers had, and the insurance companies, to do their business in opacity, where no one knew what prices they hashed out, I think all that will be gone in a few years. And once these prices are there for everyone to see, I think there will be harder pushback on prices, to the point that I think they could actually go down.
Those are all interesting points. I time will tell, obviously, and I wouldn't necessarily predict against what you're saying there. I think it's certainly possible. I think as I was trying to allude to with my comments about the employer system and Medicare, I do think that there's still a possibility that and I can't really even envision it, but I keep hearing about it, of the next stage medical system provisions that could still be quite expensive. Just imagine organ transplantation of artificial organs to replace, the natural biological organs that we have. People are predicting, we'll have that in 10 years, and imagine what that might mean for expenses in the Medicare program. And obviously the joint replacement movement has already taken off, but there's still a lot of upward room there. I mean, we might all have new knees and hips and elbows and whatever else 30 years from now. So it's quite true that the pricing system could become more transparent, but with income growth and new ability to take care of people, especially in their older years, I just wouldn't rule out the notion that there's still much, much expense out there that could be associated with our medical system.
No, I think that's hard to disagree with. In fact, I think Sheila Smith and Joe Newhouse, they did this paper, and I think technology definitely is a major driver of health spending growth. Used to be said that it was 50% of the growth. I think they're down to 30%. But nevertheless, new technology definitely has driven health spending. And I don't know, but I always wonder, the obesity epidemic we now have is really like a mortgage that we're writing that at some point will yield a lot of illness that has to be taken care of. And what obesity may cost us in the future is, again, a sort of an open book, where Jim is right. There are more uncertainties now than I think we'd faced before.
And just to throw in one more thing, we were talking a little bit ago about the low rate of price inflation that's in the paper. But one of the issues that people have talked about in a concerned way is the provider consolidation that has been going on and in some ways is encouraged by the Affordable Care Act. And the hope is obviously that it's used to provide coordinated care, to make the system work better. But obviously, the worry is that the provider consolidation makes providers more powerful in terms, at least on the private side, of negotiating higher prices. Do you see that as a either of you see that as a real threat to that low level of price inflation you were talking about earlier?
Well, if you ask me, I think every economist has that worry. I would imagine Jim would too, because you might very well have these huge behemoth of ACOs, and yes, they get bundled payments, but the bundle costs the bundle, and it could very well not be cheaper. I think that worry is definitely there. I think the FTC is worried about it. I don't know what Jim thinks, but the ACO, a lot of us think, probably might enhance the quality of care you're getting, but it's not necessarily clear that that'll save a lot of money. I wouldn't believe that it would.
Yeah, I would agree with Uwe on the basic point that obviously hospital consolidation. There's plenty of academic evidence that the hospital consolidations that are occurring is driving up prices, and you know, tipping the leverage point to these hospital systems that can just drive the price is pretty much as high as they want. So, you know, obviously that's a concern. I think the question is whether or not the system can work around that to some degree. And I'm encouraged by the WellPoint CalPERS reference pricing thing. A lot of that is for procedures that would be taken care of in an inpatient institution, some of it outpatient. But that kind of thing, I think, can be very helpful in making an end run around that kind of you know, effort to just drive market prices higher. With respect to the ACOs, you know, I think the thought might be, you know, imagine you had an ACO in a metropolitan area, and every hospital and every physician group was in it, right? That's not too far from the truth about what might, you know, evolve over time. And so instead of having just sort of a fee-for-service system with unrelated cottage industry providers, you'd have everybody integrated supposedly under one gigantic ACO, and they're still getting paid fee-for-service rates. And then the question is, what have you really accomplished by doing that? And so I think the key there is really that the beneficiary community hasn't been brought into the ACO concept yet. They're passively assigned to the ACOs. They're not really enrolled in the ACOs. I think that's a fundamental flaw in the program that really removes the ability of the ACO to act like a competitive network differentiating itself from everyone else. And instead of that, what you have is you know, essentially fee-for-service providers and ACOs. They're on the margin, as Uwe indicated, trying to do better on quality and integrate a little bit here and there, but are they really pinching the system and driving out the low-value providers and really pushing the care toward high-productivity systems? I don't see much evidence of that yet.
Well, let me ask a little bit of a bigger picture question, which is sort of what's our capacity to really come together in a meaningful way to address the sorts of concerns and questions that you all have raised. I mean, obviously, the Affordable Care Act remains incredibly controversial. But on the other hand, when you sort of look at, let's say, somehow magically tomorrow it went away, there doesn't seem to be a big consensus on the other side as to what should replace it. You know, so far, repeal and replace has been mostly repeal. Now, I know, Jim, you and others have certainly done substantial work on what might be the replacement, but it doesn't seem like there's been anything like a consensus on what that would be. And I think about, you know, the managed care rebellion that we went through. Do you both feel like that we have an ability as a country to come together in any meaningful way to sort of figure out, you know, the flaws in the Affordable Care Act or in some other system and plug some of these holes? Or do you think we're just going to continue to sort of be doomed to suboptimality by the fact that we can't seem to agree on any sort of rational fixes, any sort of, you know, way to come together and make the system work better?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I just put Jim's paper on my reading list. that's probably was one of the better articulated alternative visions of what, say, a Republican plan could be, or an alternative plan could be. And, you know, there were plans. I always thought Tom Coburn, Senator Coburn's plan in May 2009, basically wasn't all that different from the ACO. The ACO was, again, in the end, like a freight train, and everyone loaded all kinds of stuff on it, which is always what happens when you do major health reform. Everyone gets their hobby horse on that train. But sort of the core of it, to have exchanges, to have competition, etc., there was actually an overlap one could have worked with in a bipartisan way. But you're asking us basically a political question. Maybe Jim is closer to it. I really don't know. It's really, at the moment, we basically don't really have an effective governance system in the country. Whether that'll change in the future, I don't know.
Well, the way I look at it is that actually Uwe and others have put together what I would call the sort of the next stage for those who are relatively comfortable with sort of the structure that got enacted in 2010 and are thinking, you know, what were the next steps. There's been a fair amount of work. So there was a led by Ezekiel Emanuel and others, a group of scholars. I think Uwe was...
Yeah, was part of that.
Yeah, was part of that, to sort of outline a vision for next stage cost discipline system, you know, and it presumed continuation, of course, of the healthcare law from 2010 and sort of built upon it. And then there was a paper put out by the Center for American Progress. It was, you know, very... some, you know, more detailed around the Medicare program, but a very dovetailed with that kind of concept, you know, now where do we go from here kind of concept. So, you know, to put it in simplistic political terms, if there's a new administration in 2017 and that administration has views on the health system that dovetail with the current administration, I think they'll pick up that kind of an agenda because, you know, cost control will still be an issue. The deficit will still certainly be an issue. Health entitlement, the burdens of that in the next couple of decades will certainly be an issue. And if they're looking to what do we do now kind of thing, I could see them picking up that kind of an agenda and trying to work with elements of it to bring cost discipline or put instill a little bit more cost discipline into the structure that currently exists. Now, it's on the other side, for those who are uncomfortable with the healthcare law from 2010, I think there's more of a void, and I sort of admit to that. I think that they will need to articulate more clearly both the near term, you know, if you're not going to do the healthcare law, what would you do with pre-existing conditions and coverage and reorganization of the insurance market? I do think the burden will also be on those who are against the current structure to say what are they going to do about health and entitlement reform, sort of a counterpart, if you will, to the papers I just alluded to. There was, of course, something in the New England Journal of Medicine that was a response or a counterpoint to the Emanuel et al. Paper, and that was written by Joe Antos, Gail Walensky, and Mark Pauly, sort of some of the most eminent put it, you know, and then a little bit crudely, the market-oriented type health economist pushing for a different direction from the healthcare law of 2010. So there's the beginning there, but I do think it would probably need to be fleshed out and a more robust alternative program.
Well, this has been a great discussion, but I'm obviously conscious of the fact that you both have busy schedules and we should probably be bringing this to a conclusion. But before we do, I want to give both of you an opportunity. If there's something you feel like really should be said that we haven't gotten to yet, feel free to jump in now and add it to the conversation.
You know, the only other point I had on my little notes from reading through the paper was that I do think it's noteworthy and interesting that if there's anything that's you ask the employer community out there if they see a big change that's occurred from a decade ago, I think it is interesting, and it's a little bit underreported still, is the movement toward high deductible plans. That if you go back and look at the data, I think 2005 or so, there was about 1 million people in employer-sponsored HSA high deductible type insurance models. And I think now there's 13, 14, 15 million people, depending on who you ask and what the context is, which is a pretty sizable jump. You know, and I'm not saying that that's enough to influence our whole system. Of course, it's not. But I do think even in the paper that we just reviewed, there's little bits of evidence that that is having a material effect.
Uwe, did you want to add anything?
You know, looking forward, when you actually look, people always ask, why does the U.S. spend so much more per capita on healthcare than other nations? It turns out the bulk of that actually is prices. That for almost anything you can imagine, with MRI or a pill or a physician visit, our prices are pretty much double what they would be anywhere else. And what has struck me, just sort of on a conference circuit or something, I like to hang out with venture capitalists, that there is a fair amount of activity to get price transparency and somehow to make providers post prices. And that's difficult for hospitals because if you look at the charge master, which is their fee-for-service schedule, they got 20,000 items in there. And if you ever looked at a charge master, I have, most of the items there don't have any meaning to a consumer of healthcare.
I did look once and I think I was blind for a week.
Yeah, it's crazy. What I had thought one could do on price competition would be to say you should use the DRG relative value scale for hospitals for every patient, but you allow hospitals to set their own conversion factor. Then you have only one number that needs to be revealed, because if one hospital has a conversion factor 40% higher than another hospital, you would then immediately know that everything they do will cost you 40% more. That might be one way in which you get what you really need for high deductibles is also price transparency, because to tell consumers, you know, we want you to be have more skin in the game and be a smarter shopper for healthcare, and then not give them transparent information. It's a little bit like blindfolding somebody, shoving them into Macy's, and say, go and buy shirts efficiently, but you can't see what you're looking at. So, you know, having price transparency is really important if you want to control healthcare spending by engaging consumers more, which I think it's not just a right of center idea. I think that idea is pretty much centrist now. So we do need price transparency, and I do see a lot of young people, venture guys, who actually are beginning to do that. And I think that's sort of the one wild card in all these forecasts. What will happen to prices in the future? Will they eventually again rise faster than general price inflation, or will they in fact be controlled? Because then you are only after utilization, which we Americans actually do not consume a lot more healthcare than other nations. We see the doctor less frequently. We have fewer hospital admissions, fewer hospital days. We eat fewer pills than Europeans, and so on. The only thing we do is we use more MRI things and do some more sophisticated heart surgery. But, for example, Germany does more knee replacements than we do. So we're not the heaviest users. It had been the prices in the U.S., and I believe if I were giving advice to healthcare providers, I would say when you do your five-year plan, don't assume that you can raise prices very substantially. I mean, at least have a scenario where you say prices are not going to go up all that much. I think there will be pushback.
Well, thanks to both of you. I really appreciate you joining us. It's been a great discussion. And that will do it for this edition of Health Affairs Conversations. Be sure to visit us online at healthaffairs.org, where you can subscribe to the journal and read this study, as well as our blogs and health policy briefs. You can also subscribe to our Narrative Matters podcast, available through iTunes U and on our website. Thanks to all of our guests for joining us. And thanks to Brian Dobbs, Sue Ducat, and all my health affairs colleagues who work to make this podcast possible. We'll see you next time.